The title of the talk was supposed something to be like instabilities in accretion disk. As a matter of fact, I'm going to discuss a number of topics that have been done with these people here. And I will restrict myself to three types of instabilities that occur in accretion disks. These were put forward to explain phenomena such as dwarf novae or soft X-ray transients, which are directly related to the black hole program, but also to instabilities in young stellar objects and possibilities of unsteady accretion in AGNs. Now, those three instabilities are the thermal viscous instability, which was first put forward 25 years ago. There was no explanation of the instability mechanism, but there was the idea that the disk could be thermally and viscously unstable. The basic of the thermal instability is quite simple. It's simply that the heating rate, noted here as Q plus, increases more rapidly with temperature than the cooling rate. So if you make a small perturbation, it gets unstable. Now, if one looks at the viscous instability, it's not quite the same thing in the sense that you find the well-known S-curve in the sigma TF or M dot or nu sigma curve.
Maybe it's not so well
known. Well, I will come back to that point in more details later on, but it is simply that when you find the equilibrium solution for the accretion disk, you find that as a function, if you increase the surface density, you find that the mass transfer rate increases until some critical value, and then if you go higher in mass accretion rate, then the surface density has decreased and then increases again. And if you look at the disk equations that I will show later, and you make a linear analysis of the stability in this situation, you find that the disk equation is a viscous, the viscous evolution is a diffusion equation with some numerical coefficient in front of it, which is related to the viscosity. And the linear analysis is such that if this slope here is negative, as it is in that case there, then the diffusion coefficient is negative also. And therefore, there is an instability, namely that if you make a small perturbation in the surface density of the disk, then the thing shrinks and you make a higher and higher perturbation. So this happens on a viscous time. And it turns out that the viscous instability implies also a thermal instability, because the heating rate is proportional to nu sigma. And this is also
where
nu and sigma is the surface density. So when this thing is viscously unstable, it is also thermally unstable. Now, this is indeed a local analysis at some given radius R.
Excuse me. Yep. You say viscously unstable, you mean in the sense of the Lightman-Hurley instability?
It means that when you look, well, let me, yes, same thing.
So here's the statement is that when the relationship of nu sigma and sigma, the old language, is rising to the left on this plot, is when that instability occurs. And you're saying
yes,
that coincidentally or not, that is also when you have a thermal instability on the same plane.
Yeah.
Right.
You may be thermally, the thermal instability doesn't imply viscous instability, but viscous instability implies the thermal instability. Because of here, this is a place where cooling exceeds the heating, and this is the place which is just the opposite. And so if you make a small perturbation here, you rise the temperature, and therefore there the heating is larger than cooling, and therefore you go back on the equilibrium curve, which isn't the case here. And the reason for that is that this the nu sigma, which is the heating rate, is on the same axis as the viscous analysis and thermal analysis. So we are dealing with the same quantity here. Now, as I said, this then you can imagine having cycles this way, because if you imagine that for some reason the mass transfer is in that range here, you won't be able to sit on that dash curve because it is unstable, and therefore you might imagine forming cycles this way. Now, that said, this is a local analysis because you are at a given point in the at a given position in the disk. So what matters is to decide whether there will be one point in the disk which is going to be subject to this instability. Now, in order for the disk to be unstable, you must be in between that intermediate range A and B for the mass transfer rates, and it turns out that these range depend on radius with some positive power, like 2.6 or so. And therefore, in order to be stable, you must either be everywhere on the lower cool part of the equilibrium curve here, everywhere on the disk, and therefore this implies that the mass transfer rate is lower than the minimum of all these values, which is found at the inner edge of the disk, and which is usually small, but not always. Depends on the values of the inner radius of the accretion disk. If it is, I mean, if you are close to the last innermost stable orbit, then this quantity is very small indeed. Or the other possibility is that you stay on this hot curve everywhere, which has its minimum value at the outer edge of the disk because of the radial dependence. So this is the reason for which one usually states that bright systems are stable, and systems which have mass transfer rate lower than some critical value are unstable. But you must keep in mind that at some point, if the mass transfer rate is so low that you are always on this curve here, the system is going to be stable. Now, I didn't mention the reason for this instability to occur. There is, yeah.
That lower curve, I've never been sure how good the opacities are.
I come to that point later on. Yeah, it's there are some uncertainties, but that they are not that dramatic. The reason for which you have that unstable region is that this is a point where hydrogen gets partly ionized, and the opacities become very sensitive to temperature. So I think
you can have regimes where two parts or one part of the disk is stable and the other is unstable in a continuous fashion.
Yes. And this is, I haven't taken a figure with me of that, but this is what usually happens if you make if you take the simplest assumption of a constant value of alpha.
Enlarged disk.
Enlarged disk, of course, yes. And the third instability this is a so-called tidal instability, which was put forward something like 10 years ago by Saki to explain some of the outbursts you find in dwarf novae. The basic idea is that you have a tidal torque at the edge of the disk, and this torque is what keeps the outer edge of the disk fixed at a given value, otherwise matter would just spread to infinity. Now, if the systems are compact enough, then the 3-to-1 resonance radius is inside the Roche lobe of the primary, and therefore you can reach that point. And a numerical simulation shows that the eccentricity of the disk becomes very large when you reach that 3-to-1 resonance radius.
What is this
3-to-1
resonance?
Sorry?
What is this 3-to-1 resonance?
Oh, it's a dynamical resonance when you look at particles in the orbit, and you get intersecting orbit, and this thing would dissipate quite a lot of energy. So you end up with a disk which is elliptical and precessing, and you dissipate quite a lot of energy there. So this is the reason for which what he assumed was that you increase the, when you get to that, those elliptic disks, you increase the torque by a factor of the order of tens or so, and then the disk remains elliptical for a while until its radius has, until it has shrunk enough so that it becomes circular again, and then you go back on that curve. So it's a limit cycle, but apart from the fact that it would explain dwarf novae super albus. I'll show an example in a minute. There is, and also the fact that there is indeed a sharp increase when you reach this resonance radius. There is no real good reason to assume that you have such a limit cycle which may form. It might just be that this torque just rises sharply, and there is no hysteresis as is shown here. So that this, at some point, very uncertain in my mind.
If the torque rose sharply at that radius, the surface density would drop then?
Yeah, it would force the disk to remain inside that given radius. So this would confine the disk inside that radius in the circular approximation.
Why do you think it would stay high, the torque? Because the disk is not going to be circular after this?
Well, it is because the disk was not supposed
so
to remain.
Really shrink that some part of the reach far
enough. But as I said, I mean there is no real numerical simulation that show that you can.
Yes, some numerical simulation by Murray that show that there's an increase.
Yes, this is the increase. You show the numerical simulations show an increase here. But
no
hysteresis. I mean, this hasn't been tested in a sense, so it's difficult to tell. Now, there is one.
I'm surprised to know that particle and cell such simulation wouldn't be able to do it.
It is difficult because you have to couple these dynamical calculations, which are usually SPH calculation, with the thermal evolution of the disk, because the instability is thermal and viscous. So you must couple both things.
I thought thermal and viscous didn't appear. I mean, I thought you could do a cold disk calculation. It was purely tidal. The demonstration of the tidal instability doesn't
mean. It is 3D, don't forget. It is 3D simulation.
Yeah. But, you know, if it's a purely gravitational or a dynamical effect, you don't need, need thermodynamics.
To get the hysteresis, you need thermodynamics, because this would be the result of...
This would be the result of the evolution of the disk under viscous effect, so... because the disk moves along this curve because of viscous effects. And therefore, you must find a parameter which allows you to follow this cycle, otherwise you...
In SPH, don't you have a viscosity? It's permitted.
Yeah, but it is not a real disturbance.
Yeah.
It's an artificial disturbance.
But you can demonstrate,
but you don't know if it is a physical effect. Because in the Al-Sakhi model, the tidal torque is supposed to increase the real physical disturbance.
It does. No, it doesn't. If you look. It is what he states, but if you look in his paper more carefully, the only thing he does is that he increases the torque by a factor of 10 on a range which is quite large, as a matter of fact, because it stops when the disk radius has reached two-thirds of the resonance radius, which is quite a large amplitude.
If you don't increase the viscosity, why would you increase the...
But the viscosity has already increased, and the accretion rate increases because you are forcing the disk to shrink.
You're removing
angular momentum very rapidly, so the disk is forced to shrink.
And Murray's simulation show that you, SPH simulation, that you remove angular momentum.
You do remove angular momentum. The problem is to decide whether you can have such an hysteresis cycle on a range of which is quite large, as a matter of fact.
I think that this is one of the things we could discuss.
The other thing is, these were not a cataclysmic variable, whatever, but were a relativistic central object, transparent black hole. Then wouldn't these elliptical orbits lead to a quadrupole moment in gravitational wave?
It's too far.
Too far away.
Too far. This is at that.
3-1.
Oh, is it? Sorry.
It's not very close binary. 3-1.
Yeah. it is very far to what you may neglect.
This
is the thousands of Schwarzschild radii.
So this is predicated on it being a binary? The binary is the one that causes...
Oh, yes, sure, yes. Sure. Maybe you didn't...
Oh, I didn't. This is the presence... It's a tidal interaction with the secondary, which causes this...
There's no tidal interaction.
There's an interesting case. Suppose you have merging neutron stars or whatever, then they're close.
Yeah.
This could be an interesting effect if it occurred, it could really change the nature of the merger process in the last 10 Schwarzschild radii.
It could, except that you need to have a high mass ratio.
He's right. To have this effect, because in fact this isn't really the subject of his thought, but to have the 3-to-1 or any resonances affecting the disk, the resonance radius has to be inside the lateral, which requires very
factor of 4, if I remember correctly.
Sorry?
I think the secondary must be less massive than 1/4 of the primary.
It's higher law because it depends how you define it. So you define the mass ratio as the secondary mass to the ratio of the primary mass, and it has to be less than 0.25. So you could have this if you have a black hole.
Black hole and neutron star.
Heavy black hole. A massive black hole and you can start them
and a disk.
And a disk.
Yeah, if you permit it, absolutely.
Which is.
But it's another story. But if you have neutron star, all the relevant radii are.
Besides the Roche shock, you disrupt one of the two. If you're inside the Roche law, then only one of the neutron stars gets disrupted.
Yeah, sure. Yeah.
But once this came up, there is another instability, which I looked at a long time ago, the well-known Chandrasekhar-Friedman-Schultz gravitational wave instability. That operates only above, from my estimate, 10 of the 9 solar masses, number one, because the disk mass in the linear function of the black hole mass, the relative disk mass, the linear function of the black hole mass, and because of the viscosity so large.
So, sure. Remember, at the beginning, he's telling us about the stability that we operate also in white dwarfs and young stellar objects.
I specified that I was going to talk only about three instabilities. The thermal, the viscous, and that tidal instability, which only occurs in the outer part of the accretion disk. Now, it was put forward by Yosaki to explain super outbursts in dwarf novae. I'll show in a minute what they look like. They, in principle, should also apply in, they should be visible in all subplectral transients, because especially those containing black holes, mass ratios are large enough that you can be certain that the disk radius is as large as the 3-to-1 resonance radius.
You're certain. But then you should be certain.
Which?
You're certain it's super.
Now, this is what the effect of the instability would look like. This is a system which show both normal outbursts, which are explained by the thermal viscous instability. This is time. I can't read really the scale.
This
visual magnitude versus time, this must be something. This is 100 day, I think. So very rapid recurrence of outbursts. And the magnitude varied by, this is 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. So 4 magnitudes variations in optical. And you see two types of outbursts, frequent one which are very short, and others which are longer and are called super outbursts. And these super outbursts were those for which the tidal instability was put forward, because they nearly always occur in system in which the mass ratio is large.
Were they the very long outbursts or super outbursts?
Yeah, these were
long, but not. It is the reason they are called super outbursts.
Because they are super humps. Okay. Meaning that the light curve, if you look at the light curve from on a shorter time scale, you find something like this on a period which is of the order of the orbital period, very close to the orbital period, and the amplitude is something like 0.2 magnitude, and this is due to the precession of the elliptical disk. And these were called super humps, and this is the reason for which these are called super outbursts. Also, they are not brighter. They are all at about the same luminosity, but they last much longer.
Not the average.
Well,
are
slightly brighter, but this is not even one magnitude here.
No,
this is
in this case.
They're repeating a rather regular period of 70 days or something.
Yeah, it's a sort of regular, but then they disappear.
Yeah.
This is a very particular object.
Yeah.
Well, it was just intended to show you those. I mean, this was the only figure for which I had the two outbursts.
I think it should make clear that there are two phenomena that are happening. One is the so-called super hump. You see an orbital modulation of the light curve, which is slightly longer than the orbital period. This has been a mystery for a very long time. How can a binary system change its period on such a short time scale? But then it was explained by Rob Whitehurst that this is due to the period due to this 3-to-1 resonance that deforms the disk. And then this is the period you see, this is the bit with the synodic period you see due to the deformation of the disk.
So I guess the phase information is lost after one of these super humps. You get out of phase with your normal orbital period by a factor of 3.
This is not the orbital period.
This is time, but the orbital period is very short here. The orbital period is less than a day, and here you see 100 days. You don't see the orbital period on this diagram. It's too short. These normal outbursts are the result of the thermal instability, and these were proposed to be the result of the tidal instability. Now there is one problem with that explanation, and namely,
I think that we should make clear that we see the effect of the 3-to-1 resonance in the light.
Yeah.
What Osaki proposed, this is also the
reason
cause of the super outburst,
which is something different, of course, because there is one system which normally does show only normal outbursts because its companion is too massive for the disk to reach a 3-to-1 resonance radius, which happened to have exhibited once a super outburst, which is very very particular.
With so.
No
oscillation.
Except a large long outburst that would be called super outburst, but there is no super.
But there is okay. So this is one sort of this is these are dwarf novae, so white dwarf companion. I have the permission of the organizers now. This is a good reason for showing these. Which you might have seen in the conference. These are two outbursts of two very different systems, a dwarf novae, a super outburst of a dwarf novae, and a soft X-ray transient super outburst, which are plotted on the same scale, except that for one, the time scales are changed, but the this is visual magnitude. And the scales, I think, are the same, except they are shifted. So the amplitude of the outburst is roughly the same, and the time scale are different. But you see that the properties in general are very similar for the super outburst. First, the sharp rise, sort of an exponential decay, with a possible reflare, one of several. So soft X-ray transients and super outbursts look really very much the same. I mean, in this example, you find also a number of things which. Sometimes they don't look that nice. These are a few examples. This is a soft X-ray transient with that exponential decay and then the sharp cutoff. And then it had two rebrightenings. This is a dwarf nova, exactly the same behavior, except that there were six rebrightening after the main outburst. The timescales are also very different, as I mentioned earlier, and this is another system, which is also a dwarf nova.
So here you're drawing the parallel of those rebrightenings with the ordinary dwarf nova outburst?
Yeah, the rebrightening.
They look like ordinary.
They look like ordinary. I mean, they are not ordinary in the sense that these are only seen in systems which have super outbursts. So the parallel, in some sense, is between sub-extra transients and the super outburst of dwarf novae. They look very similar, and they show those rebrightenings. They show also that more or less flat top. I mean, people say exponential decay, but there are examples in which they are just flat or there are fluctuations. I mean, it can be more complex, but there is a sharp decrease there.
But you only see this after super outburst, not after normal.
Not after normal outburst.
We
sometimes see
outbreaks.
It might be difficult to tell.
To connect this outburst with the previous super outburst, and I think there is a connection, but you quite often see sometimes, you know.
The outbursts are not regular, and you see very erratic activity. You see some sort of a periodicity, but the properties of one burst to the other may be quite different. So different time profiles, if you look more carefully. And this is extremely difficult to account for when you are trying to model these systems. Why is it interesting to model those systems, if apart from the fact that then we see them? The first thing is that it is observing transient system is not the only, but almost the only way to get information on viscosity, because the properties of optically thick, steady accretion disks are independent on viscosity. You can get a handle on viscosity only if they turn out to be optically thin, and then it's even more difficult to model them. It's only when they are transient that you see very dependence that you see the viscous timescale. Well, you can produce the normal way you produce the spectra. You know, the new to the one-third spectrum of accretion disks in quasars, when they are steady, is just independent on viscosity, and the local energy dissipation does not depend on viscosity when they are steady. So if you want to know the properties of the viscosity, then you must look at systems which are not steady and transient. For example, that property that magnetohydrodynamic instability doesn't apply when the temperature is so low that the matter is not ionized is something that can be tested and that would have observable consequences on dwarf novae.
It seems that even for steady state, the power spectrum of fluctuation, luminosity fluctuation, contains information about viscosity.
This is exactly what I said. I mean, if it is fluctuating, it is not steady. So as soon as you put the time derivative equal to zero, then you have lost all your information.
Right.
Except the only exception is when they are optically thin.
I'm not sure. I don't think this is absolutely correct. What you know the value of if you have new sigma.
Yes.
How do you know you cannot have molecular viscosity responsible for accretion?
Oh, because
you don't need to go to time dependent for that.
Don't you? Well, otherwise you would get unreasonable values for sigma, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean,
have some handle, but
these are very, very weak handles, and also
because it's orders of that magnitude.
Well, then you would have. Well, the disk would. I'm not sure, actually. I never. estimated this surface density and the total Dissima, probably it would be more massive than the primary, but than the secondary. But that this
it might be enough to go gravitation.
Yes, the, you would probably go to. Because then you determine, you are able to determine the surface density from the you see the difference between the color and effective temperature.
You see the sensor and the midterm temperature. It depends on this.
Yeah, you have to do a model calculation.
But this is not so simple to do. And the second thing you also get is that you see the processes occurring basically at the very close to the central object. For example, UV delay in dwarf novae has been something that you can explain only if the inner edge of the disk doesn't extend all the way to the white dwarf surface. EUV delay, as a matter of fact, because UV delay is not clear whether. So UV delay is when you look at. I have a transparency somewhere, and this is going to be EUV delay. Okay, this is an observation of a Cygni in this is the visual light curve here, and the dots are the EUV observations. So here this is one example in which you can't see really if there is a delay between optical and UV, but here there is a clear lag of about one day between optical and UV. And what people are, this is UV and this is optical. So UV occur about one day after the optical.
The rise. UV and the optical.
Yeah, okay, so the rise of the optical shows a time when the disk has started to be unstable, and the EUV rise shows a time at which matter, the accretion rate onto the white dwarf, has started to increase. So this is in some sense the propagation time of the instability across the accretion disk. Now if you put matter, if the accretion disk is filled with matter all the way to the stellar surface, then you can never account for those one day delay. You must put a hole inside the very close to the surface so that it takes some time to rebuild the disk in the vicinity of the white dwarf. Viscous time is something which is not really well defined, in the sense that if you are taking into account the full disks of the order of weeks or so, but this would be the viscous time at the inner edge of the disk, which so you can tune it
less
to be it's less than a day if the inner radius is as a correct value. So it's
well, the thing worry about these things is there a small magnetic field that can stand the disk off from the
that could be a possibility, of course. There is a magnetic field. There could be also.
To point out that in the signal there are two types of hardware.
Yeah. Well, again, yeah. This is. You see, this is a sharp. Now those which are very sharp rise, and this one is a much slower rise. And I will come back to that later.
Then there is a delay.
Well, in this thing, I'm not sure that you could find whether. I mean, the rise is. The time scale are small, and if you. Whether you cannot see it, I don't know whether there is one or not. There could be one delay, there could be no delay. It's very difficult to tell from this diagram because the rise is not sharp enough.
Right, so this is a classical dwarf nova?
This is a classical dwarf nova. Observed since 1890 or so.
Okay, and what I'm seeing here, is this what it's thought to be the thermal viscous outburst? This isn't a super outburst.
This is a normal outburst.
This is a normal outburst.
Two normal outbursts.
Both are normal.
Okay, two normal outbursts. Okay.
Obviously, that's the difference in the rise time.
Yeah. This is usually assumed to be an outburst which starts close to the inner edge of the disk, and this one would start close to the outer edge of the disk. So this is the reason for which they would look different. In one, the propagation time would be not the same. Okay, now back to my.
So it's the rise time, not the propagation time, that gives you an information on the viscous time. The rise time of the inner.
It is the delay between the rise time in optical, which tells you when the instability starts in the disk, and the rise in either UV if you are talking about a white dwarf, or in X-rays if you are talking about a neutron star or a black hole. That would gives you the time scale, the time it took for the instability to propagate across the disk. So it can be either the thermal time of the disk if the disk extends all the way to the compact object, or it is the thermal time plus some viscous time if the disk doesn't extend to the central object, and it has to be rebuilt in.
The propagation time is alpha times the speed of sound.
No,
roughly.
This is the thermal time. I mean propagation time, which is thermal.
Yes, which is not the thermal time.
It is the thermal time of the whole. I mean, if you define the thermal time of the disk as the time scale for thermal instability to propagate inside it.
But it's not the usual definition.
It's not the usual definition, but this is clearly, I mean, this alpha CS, alpha times the sound speed, is the thermal, I mean, it's a mixture of thermal and viscous. And
there was some debate, though, in the last few years over that propagation speed. I mean, it always used to be said, at least since Papaloid and Lynn and Pringle, that it was alpha times CS. But then it seems to me there were some models by Canizzo.
Sure.
And then there was a explanation by Vishniak.
No, but this guy with Christian Menu and Rudy Stalet wrote a paper with analyzes with the code he's going to present and shows that in fact the classical old results
does hold. I mean,
does hold.
I mean, even Canizzo find that it does hold, except that alpha, when alpha is a function of temperature, this is the only thing he does. I mean, it's always alpha CS, with alpha being a function of radius, temperature, and other quantities. So.
And that's also one thing, because you read this, you've heard, because the place you are, the subject is very popular. Most of the analyses by Vishniak, by Craig, is about cooling fronts.
And not.
We are thinking about heating fronts. And you don't have the same.
Quite right. It had to do with the exponential decay.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Okay, let me come back now to the numerical modeling. I won't enter into the details of the equation, which are not really interesting, except to point out a number of things which people should pay attention to. Mass continuity is no problem among lab momentum conservation. Here comes the tidal torque term, which surprisingly is not very well known at present. I mean, those formulae lie on work made by Papaloiser and Pringle something like 20 years ago. So this is where it comes from. Now, this C is supposed to be a constant which you adjust to have the right size of the disk. Omega is the orbital angular velocity, R the radius, nu viscosity, sigma surface density, R distance, and A the orbital separation. So it rises very sharply with the radius, so that it is essentially unimportant very close to the compact object, and this is power 5, yes. And it is important only in the very outer part of the disk.
I'm sorry, the C there, is that a constant or the sound speed?
C here is a constant.
And so one's ignorance of...
It is a constant.
It's buried in that.
It's of order one.
Not real. No, it's not of order of one. It depends on the mass ratio of the systems. You know, it's the quantity that you have to adjust in order to keep your disk, the disk size at given. Because the tidal torque would depend on the amplitude on the mass ratio M2 over M1, and this is where it should enter.
Well, does one know that C from first principles, or
it's fitting numerical calculations. But
it depends roughly on orbital parameters.
It depends roughly on orbital parameters, and the important...
First principle, is it the way the torque is dumped in by launching a wave in the disk or not?
Can't remember.
I would guess that's what it is. It's just the usual Goldratt and Tremaine thing. When you have a perturbing body, perturbing orbits and particles in the disk, they launch density waves, and you can actually calculate the principle to cut them.
I don't think it was calculated this way.
Well, I really can't remember.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, that was a long time ago, and indeed, what we would like to have is a fit of some sort of a formula taken from recent numerical calculation. I mean, those calculations exist, and we shouldn't any longer use these things.
Yeah, this depends on the dot. The new sigma is on dot. It's not clear that it depends.
The fact that it depends on m dot is nice in the sense that the size of the disk is independent of the mass transfer rate, which is nice for numerical purpose, but which might not be real. So this is one point which would deserve some more attention. Now the thermal equation is sort of not very complex. I mean, it's this cube. Temperature variations are related to heating, cooling, plus, well, this is the PdV work, and this is advection, and there is here a flux which is due, for example, which is in that case taken to be the energy carried by turbulent motions that would, for example, generate viscosity.
In the radial
direction. It doesn't really matter what sort of flux you take here. Only importance of it is to couple one radius to another, but its precise form is not really what is the most worrying thing. The dominant term usually are heating and cooling. In most places of the disk, this would be the two terms that would dominate the equation. Heating is well determined if you know the viscosity, of course. Problem is to determine cooling. Because in order to determine cooling, what you want to know is the effective temperature as a function of surface density, central temperature, and radius, of course. And this is what we calculate. But problem is that this is a time-dependent problem, and there is no reason to believe that this is a universal function, and it is normally not. So I would like to spend very few minutes on the vertical disk structure from which you calculate this cooling function. Very similar, vertical disk structure is very similar to the structure of the star, except that gravity has a special form and energy generation is not nuclear but viscous. And there, in the energy equation here, you have the viscous flux plus a time-dependent term, because the disk is not in thermal equilibrium, so you must have other terms that enter this equation, and you don't know how to deal with them. So you might take several prescriptions. The simplest is to assume that this time dependence has the same dependency as the viscous dissipation term. So you write it in the same form, where alpha would be a constant here, and then if you do that, it is equivalent to solving the vertical structure of a disk in which the viscosity parameter alpha is no longer specified. So the central temperature is given.
I think we should spend some more time, because it's very subtle.
Usually it is not stated very clearly, it is not stated explicitly. There is a major drawback when you calculate the effective temperature in the disk, because
time dependent.
When this is in equilibrium, there is of course no problem, but in the time dependent process you must find what is the cooling. So you have a time dependent term here, and you don't know what to do with it, because you have absolutely no prescription and you don't want to solve a time-dependent problem.
The equation describing the radial structure are vertically integrated, the sigma period. But of course, the disk, when it gets heated, it does this. Not really take into account. There is the height of the disk is changing, there's expansion and contraction. And this, of course, is impossible, almost impossible to describe in a vertical integrated case.
And that left hand turn, the 3/2 alpha omega kp, is that also a function of height, right, or what?
This is the standard alpha approximation in which you assume that
it's a function of time.
P is a function of time, and alpha could be a function of time if alpha is not constant, for example. P is a function of the pressure.
P is a solution of the first
equation. It's also true that alpha, for example, could be.
You don't know. You assume that alpha is in that case doesn't depend on age, which I mean nobody has any idea of what is really happening in those things. I mean, if you have magnetic loops, for example, on top of a disk, then that would not apply at all. There is no evidence for magnetic loops in CVs anyway.
We have here a 2D structure, but we decoupled the vertical structure, which is solved, not integrated. But then we get from the vertical structure the values we introduce into the radial structure. I mean, this is the old ANSAT, the Shapur and Shinyaev idea.
But you see here, there is that approximation that this time-dependent term has the same functional dependence as the viscous dissipation, or in a sense, these terms are important, more important in the central parts of the disk than the outer parts.
Which introduces an error of 50%, right?
Can I have two more questions?
Yeah.
What is your figure? You considered hyperconduction. Conduction.
Yeah.
And in that form, you assume that the practice proportional to temperature gradient. And some people assume that it will be the proportional to entropy gradient. And
do you think? Well, I...
Because we consider a compressible medium, so...
Yeah, well... This prescription here is the same prescription as Canizzo, because we wanted to have a basis for a comparison. I don't think that this term here is really what
in practice
that would give significant deviation from one solution to the other. I'm not defending that this is really physical. It's just some sort of a coupling term between one radius and the other. Because
what would happen if that term were totally absent? Then a thermal front would not propagate.
The thermal front would still propagate because of these terms here, which introduce some sort of coupling.
So we
could even leave them out. And this, I mean. It introduces some numerical difficulties because it is a second-order equation. It is frequently omitted.
That's nothing, thank you.
No, I think it doesn't. No, it doesn't. And I come back to the boundary conditions, which are the boundary conditions at the surface of a normal star. We have calculated the optically thick case and the case in which we assumed a gray atmosphere, and the results are not that different. I mean, there are some differences indeed. The solid lines, I think, are for a gray atmosphere. I can't remember now which is which.
Where they extend.
Yeah, I think the solid lines are for gray atmosphere, and the dashed lines are for an optically thick case. I mean, there is some difference, but in view of the alpha approximation, I don't think that this difference is really large. What is also interesting is that you can assume other prescription for the radial.
So I don't understand the difference.
Particularistic
diffusion
approximation.
So
that's also
It's not an atmosphere.
It's a star. Okay.
There are some differences.
Why is opticalistic rather thin?
And it should be mentioned that these points here start to be optically thin. I mean, this part of the curve is optically thin, so...
For one, it starts much higher, I think.
Yeah.
Already near the sigma max is optically
thin. Yeah, yeah, if you look at the...
Okay, and so we see the nice big S.
But you see this... Yeah, this is...
Why are there two bumps in the right hand?
I think that this could be due to dissociation of molecular hydrogen. Probably, if I remember that. This is related to the shape of the opacity, so molecular hydrogen is an obvious explanation, but there might be other things that happen. There are also dust.
Hydrogen molecular ions.
Yeah.
Well, this is 2000, so no, it must be some dependence on the opacities.
H minus
big?
Maybe.
I think it's H minus.
I can't remember. Right. I mean, we used the Russell, I mean, the Alexander opacity at low temperature, so difficult to tell what is the main contributor of in the opacities. But as a matter of fact, there is something like a 10% uncertainty altogether in the effective temperature, which makes a factor of 50% uncertainty on the total flux, on the Q minus.
Exactly.
I mean, there
okay.
Now I'm coming to the boundary condition in the radial direction of the disk. They are, I mean, sort of standard at the inner edge. Sigma equals zero. We have a diffusion equation in temperature, if you remember, so we must have two boundary conditions for the temperature. And this isn't a well-posed problem because you would form imposing either the temperature or the temperature derivative or whatsoever would form a boundary layer in the temperature. Oh, it's
sigma zero is a new sigma.
New sigma equals zero.
The torque. The torque is zero.
But sigma is the surface density.
Sigma is the surface density, so...
This makes no much difference. If you have a non-rotating star, then the center is on the ball because numerically. But in fact, what we want to do is new sigma equals zero.
But as new, I mean, as you can make new equal zero in the Shakler-Rasse-Naïef approximation, then it means that sigma is zero.
We are not very happy with sigma.
Well, it does. I mean, it has some influence, especially because the boundary condition propagates as the square root of the radius. I mean, its effect varies as r over r in. There is, you know, this well-known factor. 1 minus r in over r, the 1/2 goes here. So it does propagate, I mean, its effects are can be felt quite far away from the central object.
So why don't you set nu equals 0 instead of sigma?
But nu equals 0 implies sigma equals 0. I mean, you can't have viscosity equals, I mean, in the if you assume the Shakler-Rasse-Naïef approximation,
I have trouble imagining an accretion disk onto a star where the surface density goes to zero at the inner edge.
Well, the surface density, you can imagine that this, I mean, you form a boundary layer anyway, but you could imagine, for example, that the surface density goes to zero because the velocity, the radial velocity becomes large. And this is what presumably happens.
Yeah, it goes to zero in the
thin disk approximation.
For the correction to thin disk, then there'd be some non-zero value there. I think it's okay if it's not the biggest uncertainty.
No.
what I wanted to mention in that this boundary condition I have taken here does not assume that the outer radius of the disk is fixed. So you have to these two account for mass conservation and angular momentum conservation, but you do not assume, as is usually done, that the outer radius of the disk is kept at a fixed given value. Well, this is simply, stating that the mass conserve, and this is the specific angular momentum of the matter which is added to the at the outer edge of the disk.
Maybe we could say, especially for Greg here, an enormous amount of so-called results in literature showing that alpha cannot be constant and this.
Depends.
The assumption that they are out is constant.
And I will. Okay, let me. Now, I was not willing to show this right now, but just.
Let me know
for quite. Yeah. Okay. If you calculate the life curve of an unstable system, assuming that the outer edge of the disk is kept constant or not, does make quite a lot of difference. I mean, they really don't look the same at all.
Sorry.
Well, okay. Yeah. Well, I won't show all that. But oh yes. The first one. Yeah, this is what you get when you keep the outer radius of the disk fixed, and this is when not variable and when you keep it fixed. So, doesn't really look the same. And you can notice in particular those long outbursts with a flat top, which you don't find when you keep the outer radius of the disk fixed.
This is very simple.
Yeah, because In that case, when you keep the outer edge of the disk fixed, what happens is that I will discuss this later.
The argument for fixed or out was that there was some.
It was simpler. No, just numerical argument. Simpler.
That's the argument. I think we also put it at first fixed. We almost forgot it was fixed.
Well, what determines our out?
The tidal talks.
All right. But so there's not some particular radius where there's this resonance that makes the torque very strong and takes
out. Well, it's the radial dependence of the torque.
But observation.
But you see the okay. I should have mentioned that you see in dwarf novae you see the outer edge of the disk vary by something like 10 to 20%.
How do you see that?
In eclipses, you can measure the impact, the impact point, the sort of hotspot gives you the...
You get a velocity?
Sorry, the
velocity? An eclipse map?
No, not even an eclipse map, just you can measure...
You measure the phase. You measure the phase of the...
From the light curve?
From the light curve, yes. Okay. From the
And you see, in particular in those... in all systems, you see that the disk vary in outbursts. It is larger.
And also, you see there's a whole compilation by Brian Ward and a collaborator of outer radius of disk in quasars and in outbursts. And you see the differences from 0.45 of the radius of the Roshloff to 0.70 something, almost like a perfect time.
Well, I used to see cartoons where the hotspot was not even at the outer edge of the disk. It somehow magically found its way into a smaller radius and got bright. I don't know. You're assuming here that the accretion stream impacts the outer edge of the disk and therefore tells you where.
Yeah.
Can you see it from the eclipse light curve? We actually see the star, the companion, crossing the outer edge of the disk. At least you can see.
There's a basic issue. What removes angular momentum from the outer edge of the disk? The disk has to get rid of angular momentum. I think in the old days, people just imagined that the disk would sort of spread out, so the angular momentum would go into a larger and larger radius with a smaller and smaller amount of mass. But if the resonances can remove torque, can remove angular momentum, then it don't transfer any matter outside.
But this is not new, you know. Joe Smack and Yoji Osaki, all the light calculated models with variable
radii.
Radii since,
and compares this with observations.
So there's nothing new about it.
Although the radius where you have some 3 to 1 resonance or something like that, that is not changing.
No, 3 to 1 resonance has nothing to do with that.
Right. It's just the fact that the effect of the companion star become more and more important when you get when you get to larger distances, mm-hmm. And then you get simply
right.
The torque from the companion.
Radius
no.
For that purpose.
No.
Well, no. There's a maximum radius, but there's
jumps huge.
Yes.
No, there is.
Okay.
I mean, this is
the tidal radius.
Okay, but where the outer edge of the disk, at least empirically, occurs inside that.
Yes.
And in that domain, there's no.
No. Okay.
How sensitive
is your radial temperature gradient equal to zero assumption?
It's not sensitive at all because simply because the dominant term in the this is something I mentioned earlier. The Q plus minus
right,
Q minus are the dominant terms. So the this assuming something Q plus not equal to Q minus at the inner and outer edge of the disk would just introduce a boundary layer, I mean, in the sense of differential equation for the temperature. And so we have taken the one which was the simplest from a numerical point of view. But the result, I mean, we have tried also to keep the temperature fixed at the inner edge or at the outer edge. And it doesn't make any difference at all. Which is fortunate. So the code we have built is a fully implicit code with an adaptive grid so that we can put the points where the physical quantities are varying. And because it is fully implicit, we can have a long full coverage of the whole cycles. So this is a good point. Of course, the bad point is that sometimes we have difficulties in numerical convergence. I mean, you are not guaranteed when you do this thing that you will find always a solution. So we spend some time to find out what to use as an initial, for example, solution to get started. It's not so obvious that... Okay, the result is that you reproduce a number of dwarf Nove Albos as in all case, I mean all codes do that, provided that alpha is not a constant. Alpha, if you take alpha equals to a constant, then you do not reproduce at all any of the dwarf Nove Albers.
What
this is something which is not always realized, that the standard Shakur-Yasinayev model doesn't work for explaining those things. What you just get is a heating front which propagates back and forth in the disk in between two fixed radii. You get a hot inner disk, a cool outer disk, and some instability which propagates in between the two. And gives just a very small modulation on which is basically sinusoidal. So this isn't what you observe anyway.
So you have to take
alpha hot and alpha cool, and this is what I have. Yes, this is quite usual, but I mean people are not always aware that alpha equals constant is not something which. You should take. I mean, this is known
the
for.
Real.
This is the real. The amplitude of the S curve is not large enough mm-hmm. for allowing you to get the outburst in dwarf Novi. You must exaggerate the amplitude of the S curve.
What does it have to assume that alpha then is different from the
on this branch than when you are on this branch here. Yes. I mean, you have some sort of interpolating formula in between, but you do change the general aspect of the S curve. I mean, you see those, and the same if you take other functional dependencies of alpha, the outcome is always the same. To change significantly the amplitude of the S curve, you want this thing to be quite large here and here.
Yes. So it's really it's not the usual. I mean, everybody's the same dwarf, right? You have to.
Yes. You cannot get a dwarf Nova Albert or
nor a suffix advantage if you don't play alpha. This has been done a couple of times.
So,
to draw S cards in which we show that you have to change the alpha.
This could impact the vertical structure, the repeating rate, the function of alpha, the function of
yes.
Z, etc. Have you put that in the vertical structure?
Yeah.
The dependence of alpha on temperature?
Oh, but no, because you assume alpha. You assume that alpha is a constant vertically.
Yeah, but that's inconsistent.
But it's
well,
not.
No. It's last I heard, it was an open question as to why alpha varies. You can model it as an alpha, which is a function of temperature. That doesn't mean there's a point on fundamental.
Right.
Could be some turbulence effect. Could be something that could affect. Who knows?
But the point is raising is probably correct when that is. Since you know that alpha varies radially for some unknown physical quantity, then you might worry that it changes vertically as well.
You bet.
But anyway, the assumption that that the viscosity is proportional to pressure, I mean, vertically in the vertical sense, is not based on anything. I mean, you could argue, for example, even if you were dealing with those magnetic loops. You could argue that that alpha has some meaning if you are talking on the vertically averaged disk, but it has no meaning in the vertical direction. So, I am not very happy with the loops, but since this was mentioned in a number of times in the
loops, won't give you a thermal
loops don't give that. They would also produce X-rays. I mean, the dwarf novae. I mean. Cataclysmic variables have disks with temperature, effective temperature of about 100,000 degrees or so when they are bright, and you don't see half of the energy going out in form of X-rays. So
you mean that the pressure?
I don't mean.
The MHD calculations are beginning to address this. How negative dissipation depends on the vertical height. And very early, you suggest there's not an enormous dependence, suggest there's not an enormous enormous delta or not. But this is still for everyone there. It's very to receive the stuff.
Also, there will be dependence on temperature.
It has nothing to do with temperature, it's an MHD model.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, this is the sort of result that we get, and that looks more or less what we see in dwarf novae, I mean, in that particular example. It is interesting because you see that there is a sharp rise and then some sort of a more or less slow decay and then a much faster decay. This is a case where the outburst starts at the outer edge of the disk. In order to have those outbursts starting at the outer edge of the disk, it is almost mandatory that you assume that the outer radius of the disk is not fixed. When you fix the outer radius of the disk, it is almost impossible, except with extremely fine tuning. I think that Kristen was able to find one example, which I was never able to find again, but in which the outburst would start at the outer edge of the disk. So it is indeed extremely important from that point of view, because the qualitative results are, I mean, not only are the light curves different, but this could be due to change. I mean, you could argue that changing the parameters alpha, for example, would give you back to a well-known situation. But this is something which is qualitatively different, and you see that the radius varies by something like 10% in total. And It does have a very strong effect.
It's easy to understand.
And it is easy to understand. Well, it is sort of easy. Yes. This is what shows the time evolution of the surface and temperature profile as a function of T of time. Let me start from, this is the surface density in green, and temperature in green, sorry, and surface density in red. In that case, instability starts here. And you see the temperature rises, becomes thermally unstable, and you get those two spikes in the surface density profile that propagates one towards the inner edge of the disk and the other towards the outer edge. Now, you are, I mean, this propagates on the short time scale. I'll come back to this in a minute. But what happens, there is a difference when the outer edge of the disk is kept fixed or not. Because when it is kept fixed, then you are pushing matters at some distance. The outer part of the disk will turn, will be on the hot branch, go on the hot branch, and the instability will stop only when the surface density has decreased by a quantity large enough that you have no more solution on the hot branch on the S curve. Now, so you empty a large fraction of the disk. Now, if you let the outer edge of the disk vary, what happens is that this spike here just propagates and increases the size of the disk. So it is much easier for the cooling, for the instability to stop and the disk to become cool in the outer part. Moreover, when the disk has returned to the low state, it contracts because of tidal torques. And this contraction is equivalent, in a sense, in adding more matter. So it is very efficient in increases during quiescence the surface density in the outer part of the disk, because you contract it simply because you are forced. The disk is contracting because of tidal torques, and therefore you can reach the critical surface density in the outer part of the disk more easily than otherwise. So the effects of keeping the disk vary is that first you don't empty the disk by this as much as you would do it if you would kept the outer edge fixed, and second, you are adding matter in quiescence because the disk is contracting. So the combination of this effect is such that you can get the outburst starting in the disk.
Can I come back to the question of the study? I mean, it seems to me that the absolute is interesting from the astrophysics point of view, but in a sense that finding out about the viscosity might be that the most fundamental.
Yeah,
it is.
Couldn't you try to specialize that aspect of these calculations, for instance, by putting in some parameterized dependence of the viscosity on things you think it might depend on, like temperature, and try to deduce by what kind of dependencies on temperature can be ruled out, because it doesn't...
Yeah, this is what we intended to do, in a sense, I mean, to get constraints on the viscosity. The problem is that before you can think of putting constraints of the viscosity, you must be sure that you have included all the important physical effects. Mm. And one important physical effect, for example, is the tidal torque. So you must, before you are talking about putting constraints on the viscosity, you must be sure that you have included the correct form of the tidal torque, otherwise you would be putting unrealistic constraints. This is one example. There are other effects which are...
How would you select what is the right viscosity?
The one that agrees with...
Oh,
it's the only thing you can do, right?
Yes.
Yeah, it's your only handle.
Yeah, exactly, but...
Well, let me show you first this thing. This is the, I mean, it measures the width of the cooling front and heating front, because I should probably have mentioned that during the time evolution of an outburst, there is a sharp jump in temperature and surface density, and which form a front, in a sense, that propagates during the heating phase here and in the cooling phase in the other way around. And you may notice that the cooling front is much broader than the heating front. But I don't want to enter into those details, but just to show you that when you plot the width of the front, this is with our code with a variable grid, 1600 point, 800 point, 400 point, and 100 point. You see that, I mean, 400 point is something which in our case is reasonable for fully resolving the thing. Now, this is a fixed grid, 1600 point, 800 point, 400 and 100. And you can see that you need at least 800 points in a if you have a fixed grid in order to be able to resolve. And there you see the discretization effect, which become really important. Even that with 1600 point, you have quite a lot of uncertainty on the width of the front. You don't really resolve what is going on. And you must keep in mind that a number of calculations were performed with as low as 20 points. So, I mean, the basic thing is that you can't forget about results we were published using only 20 points or 40 points.
No.
Well, not forget, but...
Okay, there are results by Jones Black or by Richard Sankey that are...
That, but, I mean, so far as those effects are concerned, they are really very sensitive.
But they were just reproducing some general properties,
but the particular, I mean, if you want to have precise value, then you must get to a rather high resolution. Here?
Yes.
Oh, it is just the numerical, because the front is actually smaller than one grid mesh. So you get those oscillations, it's just
numerical jump.
Yes.
This is because of the fixed grid. The front is not resolved.
The front is not resolved, so you get those oscillations here. You see that when you have a large number of points, there is no problem in the outer parts. But of course, because the grid is fixed and the front becomes thinner and thinner as you approach the central object, then there is a problem there.
Now, can you get the propagation speed of the beam wave right?
Well,
you can
if you are lucky. If you don't resolve them fully, I mean 400. I mean you see the difference. You can see the difference between those curves here. But there, when you go down to 100 points, you don't get. I mean even the light curve doesn't look the same. I mean you see a change. Not only do you have differences in rise time and decay time in the rise time of the outburst, but the general properties of the light curve would be different. With only 100 points is not sufficient to get a light curve which is the same that when you use the same grid, same code, but with a larger number of points. So there is a dependence. If you look at Canizzo's paper, for example, there is a curve which is interesting, which is the I think the interval between two outbursts as a function of the number of points, and you get something like this, and this is about 1000, the interval between two outbursts. I think that, I mean, some properties as a function of the number of grid points, and this was a factor of the order of 2. Now you might feel satisfied when looking at this curve here, but I tried to plot this in log scale, and I found the straight line, meaning that you haven't quite reached the... So you must be careful when you plot linear, you are not sure that you have reached the asymptotic value. So, I mean, this is just to tell that if the general properties of the outburst can be estimated using grids with, I mean, code with low resolution, if you want to... I mean, for example, to assert what the viscosity would be, you would require... to compare this time scale, I mean the interval between two outbursts, to observed quantities, and for that you want to know them to better than a factor of 2, I suppose.
Well,
the only thing I would like to end to do for is to Well, I'll try to finish in 5 minutes, I think, because...
I can finish it. Let's say 12.
Okay. There are a number of effects which should include, in addition to those I have mentioned. No. I mentioned the variation of the outer radius. Now, the inner radius is not something which is fixed, necessarily, at least. And you have strong indication that the inner edge of the disk is larger than the radius of the compact object, or the innermost stable radius in quiescence. For one basic reason, you see X-ray emission in quiescence from both sub-X-ray transients and dwarf novae. At luminosities which are of the order, some for sub-X-ray transient of 10 to the 32 ergs per second, meaning if you turn this into accretion rate, then you get something which is of the order of, can't remember, 10 to the 15 grams per second or so. And anyway, it is much too large for the disk to be in the cool state if the disk extends all the way down to the surface to the last stable orbit. Because this m dot critical varies as r to the point 2.6, it's written here. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if the mass transfer rate is larger than this, then the disk cannot be stable. And you know it is stable. And you measure the accretion rate from the X-ray. Yeah, you go three orders of, I mean, if you take 10 to the 6 centimeters for a neutron star, for example, then you lose a factor of 10 to the 9. And you observe accretion rate of that order. Sorry? 10 kilograms per second. So you know that the disk doesn't extend all the way to the surface. This is for sure. The disk doesn't. You cannot carry that mass transfer rate through a cool, thin disk down to the stellar surface. Now, of course, the matter could get accreted if there is an ADAF, if there is a wind, if there is a magnetic field, if whatever. But it is no longer a thin disk.
But the instability won't affect this well.
Now, the reason, a number of reasons have been put forward for that. Could be evaporation, for example, as proposed by Meyer in dwarf novae, or could be a wind, it could be formation of an ADAF if there is a black hole, or simply the compact object can be magnetized if it is not a black hole. In all cases, you can treat these things in different way, but they're very similar results. You either assume some evaporation rate in the mass conservation equation, or you assume that the radius is a function of the mass accretion rate. So that if, for example, this you obtain in a straightforward way, if you have a magnetosphere, this would be evaporation, but the results are identical, essentially. Because it doesn't depend on the way the inner part of the disk is truncated.
But then I had a problem with the inner boundary condition here. Because what Peter said,
that
we was not...
Sigma equals 0.
Sigma equals 0. The sigma equals 0, of course, is an artifact that you said both.
Yes.
Of Shakura-Sinyaev's solution, which assumes exactly no part at the inner edge. But because edge in Shakura-Sinyaev's solution, the amount of heat which is locally produced depends on the torque. The torque is 0, Q plus is 0, and therefore H is 0. And because H is 0, sigma is 0, because sigma is rho over rho times H. That's an artifact of exactly 0 torque and local heating cooling.
in circular scenario.
Yep.
Mathematical aspect. But then the reason what we assume is that h is equal to zero, and we, if we try then to have at closer to the source a flow which is not thin, then perhaps this very inner boundary condition is not particularly good.
Well, it turns out to be
better in the boundary condition in the outer disk.
It turns out to be more justified. I mean, it is the only place for which you could I could really justify that sigma equals zero, because the disk really stops where there is no longer any matter.
In there, whatever it is.
Is it the transition radius?
Yes. Transition is the inner radius of the outer disk.
Yeah, I understand it, but then I was not unhappy with sigma equal to zero as the inner boundary condition for the kind of Shapura simulation.
Yeah.
But I'm very unhappy if we are talking about this condition at the transition radius.
But
because
I mean,
then you imagine that you have something going to zero and then blowing up.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This is representing the part of the disk that is not affected by the stability.
But you say the fork might still be small. Even
no, it's not that. A problem.
Right?
It's not, then, okay. Just...
You're saying the fork might still be small, even though you have an ADAP or budding the disk, right?
No. I will also say why I am unhappy. Because I think that realistically, it is never that you have transition radius at just one radius. What when people try to calculate kind of toy models for the transition, not with assuming very realistic physics, but looking at how hydrodynamics will work, then it is never that you have thin disk and then it blows up to the thick disk
or one metal.
This is why I'm saying I'm unhappy. Because then this transition region is of the order of R itself.
Sure.
And never this kind of boundary condition satisfied. And it is in fact realistic.
Yeah, but the problem is it satisfied for the propagation of the heat front when this is unstable? And we have a young collaborator, Christian Bellu, who had to go to London Fine back today. You should talk to him because he has a similar attitude, and he invented 10 or I don't know how many realistic evaporation laws, etc., with the result that they produce.
Yeah, what
so
I what
you are,
I
you're right in principle.
You're,
you
okay. Let
this
let me mention that I used some sort of a prescription. I mean, a simple analytic prescription, assuming some evaporation law, and then of course you decide that the disk stops when there is no longer any that when all the matter has evaporated. So therefore, if you use this, then you use sigma equals zero. That seems reasonable. Any because it, as you mentioned, it occurs only on the scale of the order of the inner radius or smaller. I mean, this was a power law dependence, so same sort of thing. It doesn't affect what happens in the outer parts of the disk. So the results were basically the same. And in view of the fact that we have no idea of what this really is, I mean,
yeah.
Then.
Yeah. About the inner radius, you don't take into account perhaps completely negligible the heating by the boundary layer itself.
Let me come back to my next transparency then, because of course there is another effect, which is illumination. Illumination of.
I may say just very quickly that I of course agree with what you said that. This type of inner boundary condition will have no or little influence for the outer disk. I fully agree with this. I only thought that you said that would be that because you don't know what is in the inner part of the disk, starting from this inner boundary condition, it would be a good idea to study what is in closer to the star. And with this I have difficulty, not with the outer disk.
It's not, no, what I mentioned would be that if you are able, I mean, what you can do is decide at which point is the transition radius, for example. This would be given by the outer disk model. And then afterwards, you don't know what happens in the innermost, in the ADA or whatever, but at least you know its position. And to my knowledge, this is almost the only way to determine from observational properties where the inner, what is the extent of the inner, inner part of the disk, ADA or whatever, from UV delays, for example, or. The transition. You determine the transition from the properties of the outer disk, and you use those boundary conditions that I've used. But of course, this doesn't tell you what happens in what are the physical properties in fact. But you know at least the physical extent, which is better than.
We are not into the thing that an etching glass or bite. We neglect the inner part.
Yes.
When the inner part becomes more important, we stop our
yes, and I do agree. I just misunderstood you.
Okay, I'm sorry.
I thought that you are saying that would be a good start to calculate what is inside.
No. Okay.
Do the observations allow you to determine anything about the radial width of the transition region?
No.
So it could be very broad, but very narrow.
Sure. But you wouldn't expect. The only thing is that you would assume that the transition width the width of the transition region wouldn't be larger than the radius. This is what you implicitly assume.
What you said, sure. There is at least one case, which is 1655 -4, in which we modeled the rise to all the ways. And yes. I think if the transition radius was not, and the transition radius, if the end of the outer disk, all this was not a rather precise place, then you would get the observed delay from our model.
But it doesn't. It doesn't tell you what is the width of the transition region, because in that case we have modeled this by evaporation, and therefore you have an evaporation rate as a function of radius, so you don't know. On which radial range does the evaporation take place?
Yeah.
So, So, we'll just finish by mentioning illumination. The illumination, first of all, the disk can be illuminated. Can be illuminated by the central object if it is a white dwarf, because the white dwarf stands quite large distances above the disk, and all parts of this do see the white dwarf. This is the simplest case, I believe. It can be also illuminated by the central part of the disk itself, or the corona, in the case of soft X-ray transients and X-ray sources, and this is much more difficult to model. In any case, illumination changes the stability if the radiation temperature is of the order of, say, 8,000 degrees or so, the ionization temperature. Then you would make these parts of the disk which are illuminated stable. It is not the only effect, contrary to what has been said on a number of occasions, because if it does make those illuminated regions stable, it renders very unstable regions which are in between the illuminated parts and the unilluminated ones. Namely, imagine, for example, you have a white dwarf which is illuminating a disk with a high temperature, surface temperature. So close to the white dwarf, the temperature, even in the low state, is going to be of the order of, say, 20,000 degrees. So the disk is going to be stable and hot. And very far away, the disk is going to be cool, because it is in the low state, and there's going to be a transition at around 8,000 degrees or so, and this region is going to be pretty much unstable. In a similar way, when you have, if you have trans, this will cause as reflares, as a matter of fact, because this point of instability, when you have a cooling front that propagates inwards, will realize that the inner part of this cannot be as cool as it would like to, and then there it's reflected in a sense. So this, because the points which are illuminated at that critical illumination temperature are much more unstable than previously, you would get reflares. Another effect of irradiation, and this will be the last effect I'll discuss, is the irradiation of the secondary. In the case of X-ray binary sources, it's not clear what fraction of the secondary is illuminated and what is the effect on the mass transfer rate from the primary. However, in dwarf novae, the secondary is observed to be illuminated. There is in the system such as WZ Sagittae, for example, the surface temperature of the secondary is of the order of, 3,000 in quiescence? About 2,000 or so, and it rises to 17,000 in outburst. So, X-rays, I mean, the primary is really heated very strongly by the UV, X-ray, and optical emission from the accretion disk. Also, this would naturally lead to an increase in the mass transfer rate. And you see in dwarf novae also that the mass transfer rate from the primary is increased because you see an increase of the bright spot luminosity, which is directly related to the mass transfer rate. So you can either make some nice calculation, but we tried this long time ago and it wasn't very convincing. The simplest thing would be to assume some sort of a linear relation between the mass rate which is transferred from the secondary and the mass which is accreted from onto the primary. Now, if you put all these effects together, variations of the inner radius of the inner edge of the disk and illumination effect, then you can get a number of light curves which are not so different from what you see in the observed cases. You see quite a large variety of light curves, and you would like the model to account for them. This is, for example, a case where you get reflex. These are normal outbursts and reflex. No irradiation of the secondary from that case. Mass transfer rate is kept constant. And just to end with another interesting case, which really looks silly, except that there is one system which has that very light curve. I mean, you wouldn't be able, well, the time axis could be different, but you wouldn't distinguish. I think we've seen them in Kyoto last November, and this really looks the same as the... Yeah, it wasn't on purpose. I mean, you may also look at the parameters which might not be. I mean, 35,000 degrees is a bit too high for the primary surface temperature. But I mean, it means that. Super outbursts, and with a number of small intermediate outbursts, and you can get a very narrow cycle. I mean, very short cycle.
In fact, it's so rapid, it's so fancy that even the short outbursts, the
normal outbursts,
still keep the
super hum. In the observed case, there is no super hum.
No,
of course. It's interesting to consider also that there is no tidal instability in that model. Yes. So it means that you can reproduce super outbursts without the tidal instability, which, I mean, it's interesting because it will cause some debate on whether this instability does exist or not.
At the same meeting in Kyoto, the student of Osaki showed exactly the same light obtained by the tidal
phenomenon. You say you got a code, you should be able to see why the super outbursts
and then the outbursts in the
point. Oh, well, these are dominated by illumination of the secondary. Then the in that case,
so
you. Yeah, you increase the mass transfer rate from the secondary, and this is the reason for which you get that long plateau. And there, the disk empties before mass transfer from the secondary has time to have an effect on the disk. So you see that. Well, this is, to tell the truth, it is not completely compatible with observations because this is a distinctive feature of both our model and Osaki's model. If you look at those, this is what Smack pointed out. Those small outbursts here show, I mean, they are increasing And observations show that they are flat, and it is extremely difficult to have the maximum luminosity constant. I pointed out that this would be impossible. I'm not sure that it is, but I mean, I don't see any simple way of doing that. So the conclusion would be that before we can get a handle on the viscosity, which was the initial purpose of this, you must really include a number of effects which are not simple and which are numerous. So maybe we will learn more about the effect of illumination of secondaries than on the viscosity, which would remain the problem open.
I hear there are lots of complications and lots of systems. I'm just wondering whether, is it possible to identify which is the simplest system of all, ignore all the other complicated ones, and then concentrate on that one, and then, one where you know that, for instance, I don't know whether cataclysmic variables are the simplest system, well, maybe they are, but, you have a central star that moves up thing. You have a nearby secondary that gives you trouble. So I'm not sure. Would a black hole accretion system be simpler for that?
They could be simpler. They have the difficulties, and there are only few of them. There are thousands of
hundreds
of
them. Right, but
with the complication, also they have the habit of going into transient behavior every 50 years.
Yeah, so you don't even, I mean, you don't